So, welcome everybody. We started a new series last week. We started a new series looking at the Dharma through stories and symbols. So as we said last week, this isn't a sort of attempt to do the illustrated, dumbed down Dharma. It's because symbols, myth, is, if you like, what Sangharakshita calls the language of the depths. It speaks to the parts of us that logic and reason can't reach. So it's a very important, as it were, way that the enlightened mind seeks to communicate with us is through symbols and stories. We started off this look at the Dharma through symbols and stories by looking at the wheel of life. So this is what we started looking at last week. And we saw last week that the wheel of life, if you like, it's a symbol of our existential situation. It's a symbol of the problem that we face. And because it's a symbol of the problem, it used to be apparently cited, well, the Buddha asked for it to be cited at the entrance to monasteries and temples. It's a symbol of what we're seeking to get away from by going into the monastery or the temple. So it's a symbol of our existential situation. It's a symbol of the ultimate vicious circle, if you like. It's the symbol of the vicious circle that happens when our past conditions the way we act in the present and the world we experience in the present, and then the way we respond in the present creates the future, which becomes the past, which conditions the way we respond in the present, etc., etc. So that if we're not careful, if we don't do something to break into that circle, we're sort of on automatic pilot. Life is living us rather than us living life. We're responding to our conditioning, creating more conditioning, and so on. And we don't have any choice. So we just go round and round and round. And we saw last week that the centre, the driving force, if you like, for this treadmill that doesn't get anywhere, is symbolised by these three animals, the cock, the snake and the pig, which symbolise greed, hatred and delusion. So what drives us round and round this is our greed and our hate and our delusion. Or if you like, it's our want, our desire to grab things, and our dislike and fear with which we push other things away. So the world is constantly presenting us with stuff which we seek to either grab or push away. And the delusion that that's based on. So those three animals, the cock, the snake and the pig, represent the driving force. They're what's doing the cycling on the wheel of life. And if you look at them, so that's the central circle. If you look beyond that, there's another circle with beings sort of going upwards, looking happy, and beings going downwards, looking unhappy. This is a bit like the sort of Western idea of the wheel of fortune, where you've got the monkeys going up and looking really dead happy, and then a monkey on the top with a crown on his head, and then the monkey's coming down the other side with the crown spilling off. So it represents the fact that, yeah, beings do go up and down. This is a map of samsara. Beings do go up and down in samsara. It's not that there's no good things happening. It's not that there's nothing enjoyable. There are relatively good bits. There are relatively bad bits. But what there is, the good bits don't last. What we gain in one place, we lose in another. So I used the analogy last time I talked about the wheel of life at any length. I used the analogy of it being a bit like a computer game. It's a bit like a computer game where there's this sort of castle. You go in this computer game, you can be in these different realms in this castle. And in one realm, maybe you can gather all this treasure. And in another realm, you can, I don't know, grab something else. So there's things you can do to score points in the different realms. But the thing is that if you stay there, you'll always sort of come across a trapdoor that will just sort of shoot you down to a different realm where you will lose everything you've gained. So the point of the game is to get out of the castle, not to sort of grab stuff in the castle. Another analogy we might use is, say, a dream. So in a dream, or maybe we could get really rich in a dream. Or maybe we could have the most wonderful home and partner or something. Wonderful things could happen in a dream. But then we wake up and it's all gone. It's a bit like that. It's a bit, you know, the stuff we gather in the wheel of life is about as much use as the stuff we gather in a dream. It's just as temporary. It just goes. So the point is not to gather this stuff in this sort of illusory world, but to wake up to a higher dimension of reality altogether. Another analogy that I thought of is the film The Matrix. I don't know if you... Yeah, The Matrix. So The Matrix is like a virtual reality. If we live in a virtual reality, well, all sorts of apparently good things might happen in that virtual reality, but it's all empty, ultimately. And the ultimate point, if there's going to be one, must be to wake up. So you're offered the choice of the two pills, and you wake up out of the virtual reality. So it's about getting to a different dimension altogether. So the object is to get off the wheel. So that's a little bit about the wheel in general. And the wheel, if you like, as I said, it's a bit like it's a roadmap. If we took the computer game analogy, it's a bit like this is the manual. This tells us the different places we could end up in. It tells us the things we could do to get out of them. And it tells us, ultimately, how to get out of the thing altogether, how to get out of the thing and wake up altogether. But we'll come to that. So we've seen these first two segments. We've got the driving force, greed, hatred and delusion. We've got the fact that you go up and you go down. And then what we've got beyond that, outside that, there's six segments. There's a big, the great bulk of this, all of this, if you come and look at it afterwards, consists of six segments, which depict six realms, or six states of being, if you like. In Buddhism, the way Buddhism tends to look at things, you can't separate our state of being, for the nature of our consciousness, from our experience. They're two sides of the same coin. That contrasts quite strongly with what's been the dominant Western view for quite a long time, which is that matter is real. You know, this stuff is real. Matter is real. And it causes mind. So matter exists independently and separately of mind, whereas mind is dependent on matter. That's the way we've sort of been educated to think. But in Buddhism, it's much more that two sides of the same thing. And we tend to think that this sort of matter as independent stuff is the scientific way of looking at things. But it actually reflects 19th century physics. It reflects 19th century science. Whereas, say, 20th century science, that's last century's physics, is much more likely to depict the world as a sort of cloud of possibilities that only actually come into existence when perceived by a mind. So it's a much weirder way of looking at things. Although that view just hasn't sunk in to any discipline except physics. I talk to a biologist and they're still stuck very firmly in 19th century science on the whole. Our culture is still very much sort of thinks in that way. And we think that's the hard-nosed, skeptical way. This stuff's real, mind is just this sort of stuff. And we think that's sort of the skeptical, hard-nosed way of looking at things. Quite interestingly, I came across a quote from William James, the guy that wrote about religion and the... Is it William James or is it Henry James? I always get them mixed up. William. Yeah, him, William James. And he said that if we're really going to be skeptical, then what we're going to come down to is that the only thing we really know exists is consciousness. Yeah? That's the only thing we know exists. Matter, appearances, they seem to exist, but they also seem to exist in dreams and in hallucinations and in virtual realities. So it's perfectly possible to perceive supposedly solid objects that don't really exist, because we do that just about every night. They don't really exist except as products of our own mind. So it's perfectly possible that all these supposedly solid objects at least exist as a, you know, an aspect of our minds. So if we're going to be sceptical about it, we have to admit that we don't know that matter exists independently of mind. All we know exists, because we have direct experience of it, is consciousness, that we're conscious. So sometimes we're conscious of this world, and we assume this is the only one that really exists. But sometimes we're conscious of other, all sorts of other worlds, for example, in our dreams. So the traditional Buddhist view is that we sort of jointly, the two can't be separated. The two can't be separated. The outer world and consciousness, you just can't separate them. They're two aspects of the same thing. It's not like matter's real and then produces mind. The whole thing is of a piece, if you like. So the world we exist, the world we perceive, is the other side of the coin of our state of being, of who we are, sort of being who we are. So if we have a certain sort of highly refined, highly positive state of being, we can live in heaven. But if we have another sort of consciousness dominated by very negative and painful states, we could live in hell. Our experience could be hellish. And we could see the world around us as like a hell realm. So we were talking a little bit about this on our introductory class on Wednesday. And Vajratara was saying, well, you can really see this. She used to work in a hospice, apparently, or went to do volunteers at hospice. And that, you know, people at the end of their lives, living in totally radically different worlds according to the karma that they had accumulated during their life. Some incredibly negative, incredibly unhappy. Some, despite facing death, very positive, happy, liberated. Yeah? And I always tell this story, so you just have to, if you've heard it before. It's a good story, though. I'm going to tell this story. Which is the fish story, the fish, Amoghamangsa and the fish, about how people really do live in different worlds according to our states of mind. Amoghamangsa and I were once down by the Rivelin Valley, what is now the Pudding Ladies Caff, which used to be run by this centre, and there were these guys in the river catching fish. Well, we didn't know what they were doing. They just seemed to be in the river with this electrocuting things. So we went and asked them, what are you doing? And this guy said, oh, we're from English Nature or the Environment Agency or some such. And we're catching fish to see how healthy this river is. These rivers are cleaner than they've been since the Industrial Revolution. And we can find out from the growth rate of the trout that we can find out by weighing them and taking a scale whether, you know, how healthy the ecosystem is. And if we catch a grayling, there haven't been grayling in this river for 150 years. If we catch a grayling, we'll know that this river is now as pure as it was before the Industrial Revolution. And we were going, amazing, amazing. And I think at that point, this guy in the river went, got a grayling! Wow, this is such a pure, wonderful river. And then these four people came over, wandered over, and maybe this is prejudice, and maybe I shouldn't say this, but I immediately thought drug addicts. I immediately thought heroin addicts. They look really ill. They look ill, but more than ill, they look really, really unhappy. There was a big black cloud over these four people. And one of these guys came over. There's two men and two women. And one of the guys came over and said, what are you doing? And the guy said exactly the same thing he said to us. He said, we're catching fish in the river to see how clean it is. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Health of the ecosystem. And the guy said, you're not finding fish in there. Look at it, it's filthy. And the guy said, no, it's good, it's clean. No, it's not, it's filthy, look, it's full of crap. It's an open sewer. You can see there's big lumps of crap going down it. You know? I said, no, it's not. He said, well, it's quite pure. He said, no, look at the colour of it. It's really brown. He said, oh, that's just the stuff from the moors. That's just the peat from the moors makes it that colour. I said, no, it didn't used to be like that when I was a kid. Look, it's an open sewer. It's full of crap. There's no fish in that. So you've got four people standing by a river. Three of them are standing by a trout stream with grayling in, which is now as pure as it's ever been. And one is standing by an open sewer. And the difference is the state of mind. Yeah? So we really can live in a world where what is to one person a trout stream is to another an open sewer, or vice versa, according to our states of mind. So our state of mind and the world we live in are two sides of the same coin. Traditionally, these realms that are depicted on the Wheel of Life would be seen as actual realms that we're reborn in. So that would be the traditional view. You know, they're manifestations of our state of mind that would come into being when we get reborn. This is not, incidentally, any sort of punishment that would happen. It's just that we live in the sort of realm that we are. And a nice little story about that, actually, is when I once had the privilege to translate a lecture of Sangharakshita into Spanish when he was giving a talk. And this woman came up afterwards, maybe that's not relevant, but anyway, this woman came up afterwards and said to him, are you saying that I could be reborn as a chicken? And he said, no, madam, only if you think like a chicken. So if we think like a chicken, if you think like a chicken, if you feel like a chicken, if you have chicken consciousness, you're a chicken. And you live in a chicken's world. The world looks like it looks to a chicken. And maybe when you're reborn, you'll actually, you know, really have a beak and I don't know. And you'll manifest in a reality along with other chickens where you'll, who share your proclivities and you'll perceive things the same. So they're not punishments, they're just manifestations, outer manifestations of our inner states, or they're the other side of our states. And it's traditionally seen as realms. We tend to look at it a bit more psychologically, if you like, that these are states of being that all of us have inhabited, probably. Perhaps we've all been in all of them at some point. We've certainly all experienced some of them. And you could go out from this Buddhist centre and find in Sheffield people who live in any one of those states of being predominantly. So what are they? What are these states of being that we're talking about? The first of them is the realm of the devas, or gods. We call them gods. They're actually they're not like a Christian god. They're more like angels or the elves in Lord of the Rings or something like that. They're beings that live in a sort of beautiful, they're beings of beauty. They're beings that live in a beautiful realm. So it's usually depicted, the realm of the devas, the realm of the gods, is usually depicted as a sort of beautiful park-like reality, full of palaces, with really beautiful beings in it, maybe creatures of light or maybe they've got wings, they're sort of fluttering around. Lots of music. Very beautiful realm. A realm of pleasure. A realm of no effort. A realm of no suffering. And you could sort of see, each of these realms has got lots of different sort of bits of it, really. I mean, the lowest level of this could just be the level of, lots of pleasure. The level of somebody who, the beautiful people. The level of people who are well off in our very affluent society. Good looking, healthy. Loads of, lovely dwelling. Emotionally sort of reasonably healthy. Skiing, the Seychelles. Nice car, nice house. Holidays. We could, you can achieve a sort of godlike existence, if you like, of this sort of pleasure. So that's maybe the sort of lower, the slum end, the low rent end of the realm of the gods. The high rent end of the realm of the gods is the realm of meditative states. They're rather beautiful meditative states and very refined aesthetic pleasure. So, you know, it's a wonderful realm. It's a great realm. But it's not the goal. It's not the goal because it doesn't last. Even the gods wake up one day and look in the mirror and there's the grey hair, which is the harbinger of things to come. Yeah? Even the gods are subject to impermanence. The wonderful realm will wear out. And when it wears out, then the gods will really suffer. Because, you know, this sort of realm of super pleasure, no effort, no challenge, it makes you super sensitive, like the princess that couldn't sleep if her mattress was on a pea. Yeah? You get super sensitive. So to the gods, even tiny sufferings that to you and I we just take for granted are a disaster. They have no robustness. They can't make an effort to face, they can't face discomfort. Yeah? So that's how we get if we live long in the realm of the gods. We become sort of weak and etiolated. And then when things go wrong, we've got no resources. We've got no resources to deal with them. So that's the realm of the gods. The real sort of high property value bit of the Wheel of Life. The next realm that we could look at is the realm of what are called the Asuras, or Titans, often usually translated as Titans. So this is, usually it's depicted as a realm of warfare. There are these big beings with weapons all battling each other and trying to organise a raid on the realm of the gods because they're really jealous of them. So this is the realm of big, competitive, envious egos. Big, strong beings who thrive on a world of constant conflict and competition. This is the realm of the big I am. This is the realm of the personalised number plate. There are plenty of Asuras in the realm of big business and politics. But the trouble is, I mean, again, as with the gods, well, it doesn't last, does it? You can't keep winning. You can't keep winning. Eventually, you start losing. You lose your status. And then it's a complete disaster because so much of you, you know, you're so invested in being the big I am that not to be the big I am, just be one of the folk, is a real disaster. So I am always minded, when I think of what happens to Asuras, I'm minded of that picture of Margaret Thatcher as she'd been voted out of office and she's leaving and she's crying. This Asura-like woman is in tears because she's lost. Yeah? And that's what happens to Asuras, and they really don't like it. So that's the realm of the Asuras. The next realm, moving around on, not on our version, because our version goes the other way around, but anyway, the next realm is the realm of the praetors, or hungry ghosts. So this is it's often usually shown as a sort of harsh, desert, rocky world, in which it's a rather desert-like world, in which the beings have got huge bellies and tiny little mouths and really thin throats. So they've got huge appetites, which they cannot satisfy. They've got huge desire, big belly, but no way of really satisfying it. So they're constantly craving for food and drink, which they can never get enough of. But then even when they do get it, it doesn't cure their dissatisfaction. It causes pain. So the food and drink in these realms is sometimes depicted as turning into swords in their throats or their bellies. It causes more pain. Or sometimes it's depicted as turning into fire as they eat it. So even when they get it, it causes pain. So this is the world of constant addictive craving. It's the world of neurotic craving, where the thing where we desperately crave things, but they're things that can't cure our dissatisfaction. So it's the world of the addict. Yeah, it's the world of addiction, or uncontrolled sexual craving, or uncontrolled craving of any sort for something that doesn't ultimately satisfy. The Rolling Stones knew about it. Can't get no, etc. Satisfaction. Can't get no satisfaction. Steve Earle writes about it. I don't know if anyone's ever come across Steve Earle. Maybe he's a minority interest. How does that go? I can't remember. I ain't ever satisfied. Yeah, okay. So, life is just this constant search for, this constant craving for things that actually damage in the end, or actually hurt. They don't satisfy. So, we live in a society which is geared to turning out hungry ghosts. We've got an advertising industry which exists precisely to turn out hungry ghosts. It's the world, you know, it's extreme. It's the world of the addict. But there's plenty of normal people who live a life of constant craving, never satisfied, always wanting more. The hungry ghost mentality is what drives the consumer society. It's what causes our ecological problems. It's what's causing us to create great problems with the earth. It creates poverty in the underdeveloped parts of the earth because the people in the developed world eat all the wealth. We tend to blame the arseurs for that, the politicians, but it's the hungry ghosts that do it. Yeah? It's the hungry ghosts that do it. So we can meet hungry ghosts any time. And most of us spend some of our time in the hungry ghost realm. Then at the very bottom of the wheel of life, we come across the hell beings. We've really reached rock bottom now. This is the hell beings. And it looks like hell, because it is. There are lots of different sorts, actually. There's supposed to be cold hells and hot hells and crushing hells and various different sorts of hells. Because there are lots of states of extreme suffering, mental states of extreme suffering. Extremely painful psychological and emotional states. Extreme self-loathing, guilt, extreme anger, resentment, ill will, and various types of mental illness that are like hell to be in. So, people live in those states. It is possible to live in those states. And it's possible also to create those states for ourselves if we keep making unskillful decisions. By constantly choosing unskillful decisions, unethical decisions over and over again, we can make ourselves into a being who is completely cut off from what is best in themselves. And that is like hell. That will be hell. So it's not any sort of punishment. It's just that's what it's like to be like that. And it's possible to be like that. So that's the realm of the hell beings. And then moving around a little bit more, we get to the fifth realm, the animals. So this is what it says. It's the realm of the animals. It's the realm of unthinking, instinctual behavior, just focusing on instinctual desires, physical satisfaction, not in the neurotic way that the hell beings do. It's healthier than that the praetors do. It's healthier than that, but it doesn't go anywhere. You can be happy for a while just being a healthy animal, but you're at the mercy of events. You're at the mercy of others. You can't think. You can't plan ahead. Maybe there are many different sorts of animal realms. I mean, I'd much rather be a tiger or an eagle. I'd like to be an eagle. That'd be a good one. But mouse, no, we're not so keen on mice. Tapeworm, even worse, you know. There are lots of different animal realms, perhaps. But it's the realm where it lacks intelligence, it lacks culture, it lacks forethought. And then we've got the human realm. The realm that hopefully we spend some time in. And this is the best realm. This is what the teaching is. This is the best realm for making spiritual progress and for getting enlightened. While we're in the wheel, our intermediate goal is to spend as much time as we can in the human realm. So it's not... In the human realm, we can experience some of the beauty and delight of the God realm. We can experience the delights of meditation, the delights of beauty. But it doesn't have the preciousness, the lack of effort of the God realm. Humans, real humans, can stand some discomfort. They can make an effort. They've got a certain robustness about them, unlike the gods. And, I mean, it's worth pointing out that I think one of the near enemies of spiritual practice is not to want to get off the wheel, but to want to get to the God realm, to want a realm of no, a world of no effort, of delightful mental states with no effort and no challenge. But the teaching is that that's not the goal, and that's not going to last. The goal is actually to be a human, because escape from the wheel happens in the human realm. So it doesn't have we don't have the preciousness. And the lack of any ability to stand suffering of the gods, but we do get some godlike pleasures. We don't have the sort of intense individualistic aggression of the asuras. We can work together. We don't always have to be top dog. We can give authority to others when it's needed to get something done, and we can take authority ourselves without being dictators. So we don't have that intense envious individual competitiveness. We can relate to others and make sacrifices. We've got some of the aggression of the asuras, which we need to break through, but we're not dictated to by it. We don't have the intense craving of the praetors, of the hungry ghosts. We don't experience, we may have it some of the time, but we've also got quite healthy desire. We don't experience constant, intense states of suffering like the hell beings. We've got language, culture, and we can think. We've got intelligence. So, in a way, all of the other realms sort of crop up in the human realm, but in a sort of in a form that we can work with. And the goal is to get to the human realm. The goal for a lot of us is going to be to get to the human realm, where the secret door to liberation can be found, the secret gateway to get off the wheel. Which is why in the FW, you know, it's one of the reasons why in the FWBO, you know, we make the point that actually to become a healthy, happy human is a good intermediate goal for most of us. Most of us perhaps aren't gunning for a sort of full frontal assault on enlightenment right now. We've got an intermediate goal, which is to be a happy, healthy human. A responsible, ethical human who can relate positively to others, has got friends, can cooperate with others, can get things done. So a lot of spiritual practice actually aims at that. So if the goal is to get to the human realm, how do we get there? How do we get there? At least initially, the goal is to get to the human realm. So in each realm of the Wheel of Life, if you look closely, well, you don't even have to look closely at this one, there's a Buddha. There's a Buddha in each realm. Sometimes it's Avalokiteshvara in each realm. And he's offering different things to the different beings according to their needs. So in the realm of the gods, the Buddha is offering the music of impermanence. So to a god, you've got to offer something nice. You know, if you say, get your act together, pull your socks up and get out there, and, you know, well, gods aren't interested in that. So it's got to be something really nice and lovely to get through to the gods before they'll accept it. But this nice and lovely music is getting reality across to them. This won't last. This won't last. Do something to grow and develop, or you'll be very unhappy later. So it's getting across impermanence to them. So that's what is being offered in the realm of the gods. It's something which is beautiful, but carries the message of wisdom. Then in the realm of the asuras, the titans, the Buddha is carrying, he's offering a sword, he's carrying a sword, which is the sword of wisdom. There's a connection between, if you like, the energetic, thrusting personality, I think we were talking about hate types last week as well, the hate type, the competitive type, and wisdom. There definitely seems to be a connection. So the hate type, of which the Asura is a strong variety, is very impatient with untruth, very impatient with unclarity, very impatient with hedging about and niceness. They want to get to what it's really all about. Which is why I think scholars can sometimes be quite choleric, quite sort of peppery, like sometimes they are. So the Asuras are being offered something which matches their personality. They see through their state, so they see it ain't going anywhere. And they realise that they need to... They're not going to win all the time. They realise they need to show some vulnerability, join the human race, cooperate with others, or they're going somewhere they don't want to go. They can't win forever. So that's the Asuras. They're being offered the sword of wisdom. Then the hungry ghosts, in the realm of the hungry ghosts, who are always hungry for something that can never satisfy, the Buddha is offering food that really satisfies. Food that really satisfies. The hungry ghosts are sort of responding to an inner emptiness. They've got this terrible inner emptiness, which they're constantly trying to fill with whatever they could get their hands on. So the solution for them is to something that really satisfies that sense of inner emptiness. Positive emotion. Self-esteem. So positive emotion for self, positive emotion for others. Metta. Compassion for others. A sense of community, being in community with others. And most of all, a sense of higher meaning in life. A sense of some meaning in life which is beyond... which goes beyond, it's not just based on me getting my pleasures. So some sort of altruistic motive, doing things for others, doing something for others. I think it's really interesting. I looked into the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous once, because a friend of mine who was a recovering alcoholic said, I think there's some real spiritual wisdom in the 12 steps. And I mean, there's a lot in that, but ultimately, the cure in that system, the cure for the addiction of alcoholism, is seen as not as stopping being just about your own pleasure and resentments, and becoming much more about helping others, helping other addicts, helping other alcoholics. And so that gives you the food that really satisfies. You're about something beyond just your own pleasure. So that's what the Buddha is offering in that realm. He's offering food that really satisfies. Positive emotion, community, meaning in life. Then in the worst of all of the states, the hell beings, the Buddha is simply offering balm. He's offering something that takes the suffering away. Because these beings are in such a state of suffering, well, as long as that's going on, there's no way they can do anything. They're just completely dominated by this suffering. So the first step, if we're in those sorts of states, is just to find a way out of suffering. To relieve our suffering. Sympathetic human company. Perhaps a change of environment that gets us somewhere that works for us. Even perhaps chemical means, I don't know, you know, but something that stops the suffering is the first step. And then in the animal realm, the Buddha is offering a book. So he's offering a book symbolizing intelligence, learning, culture, the ability to think. So because we all spend some time in each of these different realms, different people need different things at different times. We need different things according to the realms we inhabit. And the Dharma can be much more about what we need to get out of some of these realms than it is about a full frontal approach on assault on enlightenment. Something about that. What am I going to say? Yeah, okay. So often the Dharma is about finding our way out of these different realms and into the human realm, where the gateway to freedom lies. So there's this secret door. There's this secret door in the human realm, and the key to where to find it is written in magical hieroglyphic language in the outer bit of the Wheel of Life. And Vajratara is going to tell us how to find it next week. Hooray! If you're very good.